I'm not sure if that's a good thing that you all laugh before I even started. By 2050, earlier probably, all real knowledge of old speak will have disappeared. The whole literature of the past will have been destroyed. Chaucer, Shakespeare, Milton, Byron. They'll exist only in newspeak versions. Not merely change into something different, but actually change into something contradictory of what they used to be. Now, I want to start with that quote. It actually comes from page 56 of my Penguin edition of 1984, because I think it sums up so perfectly just what has happened to Orwell's work since his death. Orwell, who was a self-declared socialist and a fighter against oppression, has come to be synonymous not with this project, but rather with the futility of any attempts to change the world, ending in anything but brutal dictatorships. Orwell has been co-opted and his message recast by the right-wing apologists for capitalism, who unjustly, I would argue, claim his legacy for their own. They blend and distort his message to reduce it to the bland formulation, capitalism good, socialism bad. I appreciate it. Looks like people have gotten the reference. Well, this co-option of Orwell has come in many forms. Some simply laughable. My favourite one is actually, if people here are from Melbourne, that's by the journalist Andrew Bolt, the right-wing commentator in the Herald Sun, who previously claimed, actually in 2001, that the greatest influences upon him personally and his work are Edmund Burke, Matthew Arnold, and George Orwell. But if such scumbags have been able to claim Orwell, I think it's because they've been allowed to do so by a left that has been only too happy to disown him. And one prominent attack on Orwell, it's a book called Inside the Myth, a collection of essays, which was published in 1984, is a great example of this. The prominent Marxist author John Neusinger, who actually wrote a book on Orwell, described it as an unholy alliance of feminists, cultural theorists, and old-fashioned Stalinists dedicated to reversing his influence. And there have been other Stalinist attacks on Orwell, but this one's significant because it came not in the 30s, when Stalinism is perhaps understandable in its context, but in the 80s, when the reality of Stalinism had been stripped bare and is utterly inexcusable. And in this work, Stephen Sedley proposes that Orwell's main focus with Animal Farm in 1984 was to prove that socialism, in whatever form, offers the common people no more hope than capitalism, and that the inefficient and occasionally benign rule of capitalism, which at least keeps the beasts in check, is a lesser evil. That proposition is Orwell's Alpha and Omega. And after a little bit of research, I discovered that this is actually quite an ironic critique from Stephen Sedley, comrades, to give him his due, Lord Justice Sir Stephen Sedley, who actually used his position as the Chief Justice of the British High Court a couple of years ago to argue that every citizen of Britain and every visitor to Britain should have a sample of their DNA taken to be put onto a national database so they could be tracked and kept under control. An Orwellian pro-establishment pursuit, if ever there was one. All right, so in this introduction, I suppose I'm going to be confronting this myth, this falsified Orwell of the right, and in its place I'm going to be insisting on a legacy of Orwell, the self-declared democratic socialist, who is a voice, and actually often a lone voice, that was ever filled with seething and irreconcilable hatred towards capitalism and towards every form of what he himself termed man's dominion over man. And I think that Orwell played a really crucial role in rejecting Stalinism from the left. And this is in a period where Stalinism and socialism were seen as being the same thing by millions of people all around the world. And I think for this, Orwell needs to be remembered and he is to be lauded. But Orwell was a contradictory figure, and his politics have much to be criticised by Marxists. Orwell was never a militant of the working class movement, and despite being a socialist, he was never a Marxist. Instead, he saw himself as being the sort of self-conscious outsider, investigating and reporting on the conditions of the working class, but never, always with a sense of independence. He never saw himself as being part of their struggles. And the fact that he did not consistently look to the working class as the main agents for social revolution, and instead was highly pessimistic about the ability of workers to change the world, meant he left a body of work that was contradictory, held together by what it was against, but without a clear program of what it was for. And it was actually these inconsistencies and these ambiguities that have left his great political works, which I actually think should be lodged deep in the left literary canon, open to falsification and co-option from the right. Okay, so Eric Arthur Blair, who was later to be known as George Orwell, was born in 1903 in Burma, which was then part of the Indian colony, to a pair of mid-level colonial administrators. His dad was actually part of the opium department. And perhaps this sounds like sort of like vaguely benevolent, you know, slowing down and making sure opium production didn't occur. They actually produced opium and sort of oversaw the production of opium to then be sold in China. Continuing on the path of his family, after graduating from the elite Eton school, Orwell joined the Burmese Imperial Police. And the experiences he had there of actually being one of the oppressors enabled him to see the dirty work of empire at close quarters. And the revulsion he felt at this position led him to leave the police in 1927 to return to England with the intention of becoming a writer. It's in this period he adopted the name George Orwell. And I think maybe it's drawing a bit too long of a bow, but this shows incredible prescience of Orwell that he realised 70 years before it happened just how hated the name Blair would become, and he changed it. So in an attempt to escape all forms of tyranny, he lived amongst those on the fringes of society, tramps, criminals, and the most destitute sections of the working class. And he captured this moment in his work Down and Out in Paris and London. He followed this with his next major political work, The Road to Wigan Pier, in which he describes not the conditions of tramps and the unemployed, but of the industrial working class and particularly the miners and their level of exploitation under capitalism. The experience of poverty and exploitation that Orwell saw led him to an indictment of the system that had created such a gap between the rich and the poor. And this rejection of capitalism was primarily not a complete one nor based upon theory, but rather from a day-to-day experience of living amongst the downtrodden and the oppressed. He was writing at this time from outside of the workers' movement. He was an isolated middle-class intellectual, all too aware of his separation from the working class. And he also held quite a deep sense of pessimism in the ability of workers to organise and fight back against the system. So he had a great sense of sympathy with workers, but he didn't think they had any agency themselves. And these attitudes were confronted by what I would argue was the main transformative moment of Orwell's life and his political career, which were the experiences he had in revolutionary Spain, which is captured in his classic book, Homage to Catalonia. So when Orwell arrived in Spain in December 36, the country was in the throes of civil war, but more importantly, it was in the throes of a working class revolution. In July of that year, the forces of Spanish reaction and fascism led by General Franco had risen in a form of a military coup, attempting to crush and contain a working class revolution. And as it went, that actually their action sparked a working class revolution. So arriving in December, Orwell later stated he originally went just to write about the war and what happened there, but instead ended up joining one of the working class militias because in his words, at that time and in that atmosphere, it seemed the only conceivable thing to do. And Orwell makes it clear that when he arrived in Spain, the revolutionary movement was already beginning to decline, but nonetheless, its effects were still very visible and left an indelible mark on Orwell, and he described it. It was the first time I'd been in a town where the working class was in the saddle. Practically every building of any size had been seized by workers and was draped with red flags or the red and black flags of the anarchists. Every wall was scrawled with the hammer and sickle and with the initials of the revolutionary parties. Every shop and cafe had an inscription saying it had been collectivised. Waiters treated you as an equal. Servile speech had disappeared. In outward appearances, it was a town in which the wealthy classes had practically ceased to exist. All this was queer and moving. There was much I did not understand, and in some ways, I did not even like it. But I recognised it immediately as a state of affairs worth fighting for. And the ideas of equality that had typified Orwell's notion of socialism no longer was a sort of moral construct it had been before he landed in Spain. Now it was actually a reality of everyday life. He could actually see it happening before him. He could see the power of working class struggle. So Orwell joined the militia linked to the PUM political party to fight on the front lines against Franco. And he actually joined the PUM after being rebuffed from the international brigades that were controlled by the Stalinist Communist Party and had him on a list of people who weren't to be trusted. And the militias for Orwell were a foretaste of socialism, where many of the normal motives of civilised life, you know, snobbishness, money grubbing, fear of the boss, had simply ceased to exist. And the politicisation Orwell experienced led him to radically alter his political outlook. He came to reject the formulation of the Stalinists that he initially had accepted, that the revolution had to be put on hold until the war had been won. Instead, he realised that the war was not simply a fight against the forces of fascism, but against the capitalist system itself, the system that had created fascism. After being shot in the neck and almost dying, he returned to Barcelona, where the revolutionary atmosphere, in the description I just read out, had basically disappeared. And it became clear that it was the Republican government that was winding back the revolution, and in particular, it was the Stalinist Communist Party winding it back. And members of the PUM, including Orwell, were hunted down and arrested on the spurious charges of being fascist spies. And the real disgrace was that many brave working-class militants who were fighting against fascism were captured, tortured, and executed by those who call themselves communists. And that these flowers of the revolutionary movement had even their names dragged through the mud and the slime in the communist-controlled press all over the world. Now, Orwell himself managed to evade capture and escape the crackdown and went back to England. And the counter-revolutionary nature of the Communist Party cemented his disgust and hatred for Stalinism and the Soviet Union. However, it's important to point out that actually, unlike many others on the left at that time and since, he did not use this as an excuse for an exodus from the camp of socialism. Instead, he correctly concluded that the totalitarian regime in the USSR bore no relationship to the democracy and workers' control that he saw in Spain and envisaged socialism to contain. Instead, he began to see his role as a cauterizing of the Stalinist disease from the socialist movement. And back in England, Orwell's role in the Poom and his open criticisms of the USSR left him a pariah to the communist-dominated left in Britain, including the publishing houses who actually wouldn't print for a long period of time, Homage to Catalonia. The paper of the Communist Party, The Daily Worker, called those like Orwell, who had volunteered in the non-communist forces to fight fascism in Spain, a stain on the honour of the British working class. And these distortions, manipulations carried out by the Stalinist press deeply impacted Orwell. The open falsification and the baseless slander were themes that would be developed later on in 1984. Now, back in England, Orwell initially regarded the approach of war in Europe with a great deal of trepidation. He saw it come in conflict as a clash between rival capitalist imperialisms and believed that through the course of such a war, Britain itself would inevitably delve down the well of totalitarianism. However, on the outbreak of World War II in September 1939, and just as significantly at the time of the signing of the Hitler-Stalin Non-Aggression Pact, Orwell did an absolute about-stand face and changed his anti-war stance for a position of what he termed revolutionary patriotism. And he explained this road to Damascus moment in the following manner. The long drilling patriotism which the middle classes go through had done its work. Once England was in a jam, it would be impossible for me to sabotage. Although it's important to point out again that this was not a renouncing of his socialism. Orwell's revolutionary patriotism was based upon a faulty prediction that Britain itself was ripe for revolution. In fact, actually begun that process. So he began to argue for a third way between the timid reformism of the Labour Party in Britain and what he saw as the 19th century doctrine of class war of the communists and the Trotskyists. And he wrote at this time, "Only revolution can save England, and that has been obvious for years. But now the revolution has started. I dare say the London gutters will have to run with blood. All right, let them. But when the red militias are billeted in the Ritz, I shall feel the England I was taught to love so long ago and for such different reasons is somehow persisting." So just as a Poom in Spain had argued that the completion of a socialist revolution was the only way to defeat Franco, Orwell believed, mistakenly, it should obviously be added, that a revolution and transition to socialism would be the only way Britain could be beat Hitler. And this attitude still placed him on the far left of the political spectrum, though he did sacrifice in this position one of the key sacrosanct principles of socialism, which is internationalism, which he saw as being as weak as straw when compared to patriotism, and argued that patriotism was in fact even stronger than class hatred. A key component to this political transformation, it was a qualitative shift to the right for Orwell, was that he had lost the brief faith he had gained in the ability of the working class to change the world for themselves. He believed that England was too united for old-fashioned class struggle, as he called it, and that workers had too much to lose, and in fact, the differences between classes were diminishing. He argued that the past 20 years had seen the upward and downward extension of the middle class on such a scale as to make the old classification of society into capitalists, proletarians, and petty bourgeois almost obsolete. So he thought that in order to create a revolution that would change British society and win the war, the socialist movement had to address itself not just to the working class, but also primarily to middle class sections, such as professionals, technicians, the intelligentsia, etc. As I said, this was a qualitative shift away from the politics that encapsulated the period of and immediately after Spain for Orwell, the period where I'd argue was actually the most consistent with his socialism. In Spain, he'd actually seen the working class as a class for itself, conscious of its own power and on the threshold of creating society anew. This is when Orwell's politics were at their clearest. But by this time, however, Orwell had lost much of his faith and began casting around for other solutions to the problem of how a revolution was to be won. So towards the end of 1942, Orwell recognised that there was certainly going to be no socialist revolution in Britain, at least in the short term. And it was at this time that he became the literary editor of the Left Labour newspaper Tribune, to which he became contributed regularly his As I Please columns. I'm not sure if comrades here are familiar with them, but they're quite well-renowned. And this period of his life has been used as ammunition by commentators such as Bernard Crick to claim him in the camp of Tribune Socialism, or what is perhaps better described as left reformism. And Orwell certainly was a strong supporter of the British Labour Party at the time of its election in 45, although privately he was disappointed with its timidity and its conservatism. And while he believed in this period that the reformist approach was all that was possible, he remained at heart a revolutionary and argued that in the long term, the only cause worth fighting for was the establishment of a united socialist states of Europe. And it was in this period that he wrote his two fables of revolution gone wrong, 1984 and Animal Farm. So Animal Farm arguably was Orwell's greatest literary triumph. You know, it's a beautifully written fairy tale with sympathetic animal characters and a really biting political symbolism. So you have Old Major, the aged wisesaw who represents Marx, Snowball who represents Leon Trotsky, Boxer, the gallant, strong but simple cart horse who symbolises the exploited working class, and Napoleon, the pig, who is the figure of Stalin, who drives Snowball from the farm to institute a brutal totalitarian regime based upon the iconic Stalinist pronouncement, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. Can people put up your hands if you've read Animal Farm? All right, you can put them down, thanks. Just wanted to make sure we're all going to be on the same page. All right, so despite its literary worth, Orwell initially had as much trouble finding a publisher for Animal Farm as he did Homage to Catalonia. It was actually written between November 1943 and February 44, but it wasn't published until 45. And this time lapse had seen quite a significant change in the political context, from a time when even the Conservative Party, the Tory Party in Britain, depicted the Soviet Union as our gallant allies of the so-called democratic countries in the fight against fascism, to the germinations of the Cold War. And interesting aside, there's actually evidence that it was perhaps Orwell himself who turned the phrase Cold War. Well, I thought that was interesting, if nobody else did. And this change in context, I think, played the decisive role in the reception of what he termed a fairy story. So despite the claiming of it by the reactionary anti-communist crusaders, Animal Farm itself, I would argue, offers very little support for the conservative right. The book wholeheartedly endorses the initial revolutionary act, where under the leadership of the pig Snowball, the animals of Animal Farm depose of their despotic master, Mr. Jones. And as this initial revolutionary movement degenerates into the totalitarianism of the pig Napoleon, the criticism that Orwell is making is not that the animals were instituting socialism, but rather that the new regime led by the pigs was a betrayal of socialism. That the pigs, who were forming a new ruling elite, were becoming indistinguishable from the hated humans who exploited animals elsewhere, just as the pigs were doing on Animal Farm itself. And some left commentators have painted, you know, fairly bleak pictures of what Orwell was expressing with Animal Farm. For instance, John Molyneux, a socialist in Britain, concludes that in Animal Farm, Orwell gives no way to understand the reason for the revolution's failure, except for that of human nature. Leaving the book with the reactionary message, at the core of it all revolutions fail. And while I think these do have some worth, I actually don't totally agree that Orwell lays the blame purely at the door of human nature, nor that Orwell offers simply a pessimistic dirge on the inevitability of all revolutions ending in defeat. Orwell himself wrote of his intentions with Animal Farm. I meant the moral to be that revolutions are only a radical improvement when the masses are alert and know how to chuck out their leaders as soon as the latter have done their job. Orwell, in fact, saw one of the major barriers to a successful revolution in a supposed inherent corruptibility in all revolutionary leaders, actually including those of the stature of Trotsky, who is represented by the pig Snowball and Animal Farm. He explicitly refuted the argument that the degeneration of the Russian Revolution derived simply from personal wickedness, particularly of Stalin, and instead argued that they were probably inherent from the very start in the aims and nature of the Bolshevik Party, obviously something that Socialist Alternative would disagree with. He explains, "What I was trying to say was, you can't have a revolution unless you make it for yourself. There is no such thing as a benevolent dictatorship." So Orwell was arguing that whatever the experience in Russia, there was no inevitability that workers would make the same mistake elsewhere. What happens in Russia would not necessarily happen in Britain. Insofar as Orwell's intent, looking at a couple more things that he wrote himself about the book, in the period actually where its co-option by the right was becoming clear. In a preface to the Ukrainian edition of Animal Farm, Orwell explained, "For the past 10 years, I have been convinced that the destruction of the Soviet myth was essential if we wanted a revival of the socialist movement." And Orwell's attitudes and writings were informed by the threat that he envisioned Soviet communism to pose to the prospects for socialism in Britain. The main problem for Orwell was not pro-Soviet sentiment in society at large, but rather the particular strength of pro-Soviet, what he called power worship, on the left. And this is what gave his anti-Stalinism its incredible verve. I don't think Animal Farm actually is the first step in a long march to the neoconservative right by Orwell. But there do remain many criticisms that socialists in our tradition should make of it. In particular, I think, the rather condescending portrayal of the working class through the courageous yet idiotic compliant horse Boxer, who, of course, in the end, gets betrayed and shipped off to the glue factory. I think also the labelling of all revolutionary leadership as inherently corrupt, intent on power for its own sake, is ahistorical and wrong. But despite these criticisms of the piece, it is still a great work of anti-Stalinist literature, and unlike so many other popular critiques of Stalinism, it's actually written from the perspective of the left, not against revolution, but against its corruption. Now, Orwell's most famous work, 1984, was originally conceived as an attack on the totalitarianism of both the fascist and Stalinist variety. A lot of its work can be found, can be found in the As I Please column he was writing during the Second World War. But the defeat of Nazi Germany allowed Orwell to focus his fire on the totalitarianism of the USSR and on the blind power worship of much of the left intelligentsia that let the myth of Stalinist socialism gain hold. For Orwell, it was this managerial middle class who would make the Third Way revolution alongside the working class, but first they had to be ripped away from the Stalinist myth. He argued that the British intelligentsia swallowed the lies and deceptions of Stalin and his party cronies around the world because they have no experience of anything except liberalism, and they couldn't imagine what a despotic regime is like. And I'd argue, actually, that the driving force of 1984 was at least partially to remedy this with his own satirical vision of totalitarian rule in England. So, once again, 1984? Good. We're on the same page again. So, Winston Smith, the main protagonist, is living in the futuristic totalitarian Oceania, a place where nothing was your own except the few cubic centimetres inside your skull. Oceania is a superpower that's ultimately at permanent war with the world's two other powers, Eurasia and East Asia. Winston lives under the constant surveillance of Big Brother and the Fort Police for any word or thought against the system. And he works in a propaganda department aptly called the Ministry of Truth, where his job is to rewrite the past. And from this ministry comes one of the most famous of all Orwellian slogans, in which I think Orwell actually quite brilliantly captures the doublethink of totalitarian mind control. And it is, war is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength. I think the Republican Party actually had that as their motto last election. So much of this is a direct attack on the USSR, on its totalitarianism and its denial of liberty, but also the widespread fabrication of history and facts. Much of the imagery and atmosphere that Orwell employs came directly, I would argue, from his experiences in Spain, where he was hounded by the Russian Secret Service or the Fort Police, and where the question of the fabrication of history is perpetrated, of course, by the fascist, but definitely by the communist, was a major concern of his. The main element of hope in 1984 to rid the world of this monstrous dictatorship is in the working class or the proles. Winston Smith reiterates time and time again throughout the book, if there is hope, it lies in the proles. Now, this is a key debate, I think, within 1984, and it's come up a bit on the left. Does Smith, and by extension Orwell, really believe this? Is there hope amongst the despair, or in this all-powerful dystopia, is this vain hope in the proles merely another literary device to underline the futility of revolt when Smith eventually is crushed by the agents of Big Brother? And for those comrades who didn't put up your hands, I'm sorry to reveal the ending for you. Lee Wengraff, who's writing in the American International Socialist Review, does argue this, saying, Orwell can't really believe that hope lies in the proles because he slams that door shut whenever it is open, showing the proles without class consciousness or willingness to fight. They stumble along like beer-drinking animals. Winston Smith describes a seemingly insoluble paradox. Until they become conscious, they will never rebel. Until after they have rebelled, they cannot become conscious. This view completely dismisses any idea that the working class is a force for change. And I personally actually believe this to be a fundamentally one-sided view of the proles as Orwell presents them. I think Orwell depicts the proles as both the unconscious and hapless victims of society, the objects of history, and as the only possible force for social change. I think this is a melding together of two earlier stages of his political career. The documenting of the working class and their foibles as the outsider in the Rota Wigan Pier, and at least some elements of the experience of the possibility for working class revolt and revolution in Orange and Catalonia. I would suggest that the depiction of the proles relates more to Orwell's view of the possibility of social revolt in his own time, and that for a number of reasons, in the short term, it can only be worked towards as a future possibility. But that the potential is there, that it is there bubbling beneath the surface to rise again from the city streets and factories, from the washing lines and the schoolyards, and to once again pose the dream that Orwell himself had witnessed in Spain as a possible reality. And speaking about Orwell's situation at this time, once again, the words of Winston Smith. And he's describing the proles. Out of those mighty loins, a race of conscious beings must one day come. You were the dead. Theirs was the future. But you could share in the future if you kept alive the mind as they kept alive the body and passed on the secret doctrine that 2 + 2 = 4. Smith and Orwell were striving for what limited goals they believed possible in their period, but always with one eye looking forward to the better future they had faith could come if it was fought for. And in this period, actually far from renouncing his links to socialism, Orwell took every opportunity to publicly restate them. He wrote in 1947, "Every line of serious work that I've written since 1936 has been written directly or indirectly against totalitarianism and for democratic socialism, as I understand it." Orwell was not using the nightmare of 1984 as a fatalistic prophecy of what the world would look like. Unlike other dystopian writers of the time, he was not arguing the inevitability of such darkness. Rather, he was using his novel to make a political intervention, an argument to the left at the time, and a warning of what could happen. He wrote to a branch of the American Auto Workers Union, "My recent novel is not intended as an attack on socialism. The moral to be drawn from this dangerous nightmare situation is a simple one. Don't let it happen. It depends on you." And once again, none of this is a comfort to the neoconservative right. But there are a number of ambiguities that exist in the novel, such as, well, what is the ultimate drive for power behind the ruling regime? You know, what motivates them? Orwell bends towards an answer, one that's not really based on material realities, but more on the need for power for power's own sake and these sort of things. However, I would argue that despite these ambiguities, the major reason why this book was left open to claimants that it was an attack on socialism was actually not primarily due to the book's weaknesses themselves or because of Orwell. In fact, as I said, Orwell took steps to reclaim it from the right. The main reason why this book was claimed from the left with such ease was because of the political corruption of much of the established left at the time and since. Because the left in Britain and the US was so dominated by Stalinists of various shades who insisted against all criticism that Stalinism and socialism were the same thing. And this laid a framework for any attack on Soviet communism being received as an attack upon socialism itself. The problem was not any alleged conservatism on the part of Orwell, but rather the left's continued endorsement of Stalinism. And I think there's a question that needs to be posed here. When 1984 was being written and published, the Stalinists around the world were supporting the purges in Russia, they were supporting the tortures, they were supporting the counter-revolutionary policy in Spain, and they were supporting the mass slave labour camps, the gulags. Between they and Orwell, who did the socialist movement more harm? And I think the final thing to say about 1984 is just how deeply it has seeped into everyday culture. The term Orwellian does not simply refer to a nightmarish dystopias. I think really it applies to the world we live in today, and particularly the world since the War on Terror. You know, think about it, a war without end, designed to be without end, so as to prop up a corrupt ruling elite, a war based largely upon fictional enemies. The mass corruption of the truth in the media, doublespeak, the stripping away of civil liberties and constant surveillance of our activities, and crimes that actually don't need to have been committed for you to be found guilty of them. Orwell's dystopia, I don't think, is a historical curiosity that lost its relevance today the USSR came tumbling down. I think it speaks directly to the experience of the so-called liberal democracies and the war on terror today. All right, start to sum up. For much of Orwell's career, socialism was a moral prospect. It was something you were or something you thought would be nice and not necessarily an achievable goal. The less socialism looked possible to Orwell, the more he compromised and shifted the principles of socialism. And there are a number of examples of this. You know, his readmittance to the ranks of the Patriots, his so-called lesser evilism, he stated publicly in a case of nuclear war or any form of war between the US and the USSR, he would back the US. And his infamous list of names, where he turned over a notebook filled with names of possible communist sympathisers to the Labour government's internal research department. And really, I think we just have to say, we don't know what Orwell's politics would be today. We don't know what he'd be saying if he was around. As Bernard Crick rightly pointed out, the only thing we can really be sure about Orwell if he was alive today is he'd be bloody old. But I would argue, in fact, Orwell should be remembered by our tradition. And while he was never a Marxist, there are many points of agreement that we can share with him, as long as we never lose sight of our criticisms. The one constant, and arguably the only one, of Orwell's politics throughout this period was his socialism. He was adapted, melded, morphed and changed, but he never lost that commitment to the future, to a better world, if not a perfect one. And so I'm going to finish now, as I began, with the words of George Orwell from 1984. And I think these are the last words on the question, was George Orwell anti-socialist? And I also think they're words very much meant for our time as much as his. And they're the words of Winston Smith looking upon a proud woman, and he says, "It was curious to think that the sky was the same for everybody, in Eurasia and East Asia as well as here. And the people under the sky were also very much the same, everywhere, all over the world, hundreds of thousands, millions of people, just like this, people ignorant of another's existence, held apart by walls of hatred and lies, and yet almost exactly the same people. People who had never learned to think, but who were storing up in their hearts and bellies and muscles the power that would one day overrun the world. If there was hope, it lay with the proles. The future belonged to the proles. The proles were immortal. You cannot doubt it when you look at that valiant figure in the yard. In the end, their awakening would come."